Om. This may or may not work, so you may have to get the audio from here. Okay, let's start. And this one. All right. Sahana vavatu, sahanau bhunaktu, sahavidyan karavavahai, tejasvinavadhi tamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shantihi, chaitanyam sarvagam sarvam, sarvabhutaguhashayam, yat sarva visayatitam, tasmai sarva vide namaha. Good. Welcome to you all. Welcome also to the many students regularly attending online. We continue our study of the this 17th chapter of Upadesha Sahasri. At the end of our last class, we had a important discussion about the dream metaphor. Swapna means dream. Swapna drishtanta, dream metaphor. And it's important to know that metaphors can be used in different contexts. We use this dream metaphor in several ways to establish several different points, and if we're not clear about what the metaphor is meant for, we can get really confused. So at the end of the last class, we talked about a very typical application of that metaphor, which is to say the world is not as real as it seems. During a dream, the dream world seems absolutely real. And as soon as you wake up, you know it's not real. In the same way, this world seems absolutely real. You wake up out of the dream of ignorance, so to speak, and you discover it's not as real as it seems. So that's one application of the dream metaphor. We discussed that last week. Another common application is to say that you are the observer of whatever happens in your dream world, just as you are the observer of everything that happens right now in a waking state. You are the observer of whatever happens in a dream state. You're the observer of nothing happening in the state of deep sleep. So that's another application of that dream metaphor. Today's application that Shankaracharya is giving here is less common, but in a way much more powerful. There's something absolutely unique happens in a dream. That is, in the dream, you are there as the observer, and everything you observed are forms of you, forms of your own consciousness. Everything in your dream world is a projection of your mind, the content of all mental vrittis, mental activity, is the content of a thought, as we've said many times. The content of every thought is consciousness. Just as this chair is made of fabric and wood, we can say that thoughts are made of consciousness. Dream is made of thoughts. A tree in your dream is not made of wood. A tree in your dream is a thought. And what are those thoughts made of? Consciousness. So look at the irony. It is sort of an irony. Suppose you see a dream Suppose you see a tree in your dream. So the seer, you, our consciousness. The seen, the tree, is consciousness. That division between knower and known, seer and seen, is obliterated, so to speak, in a dream. It doesn't exist. I mean, in the dream, you don't think like that, because in the dream, you're dreaming. But now in a waking state, we can reflect on that experience. And its uniqueness is that there, the knower and known, the subject and object, are one and the same. There is no duality in a dream. This is Advaita Vedanta. So here is the use of a dream metaphor in a very powerful way to establish Advaita, non-duality. In a dream, there is only one underlying reality is present in the dream. That one underlying reality is present in the form of consciousness with the forms of all the objects you see in a dream. That same... That same consciousness is present as you, the dreamer. In a dream, there is only consciousness. Consciousness plus forms, but as we've observed before, forms are not a thing in addition to the consciousness. So if we establish, and by the way, just remember that, is this one thing or two? We can call it pot, we can call it clay, but it's one thing. There's no duality here. Form is not a second thing. The thing is clay. Form is not in addition to the clay. It's like superimposed. It's a non-real conditioning factor. We have to use the Sanskrit, upadhi. Anyway, we'll set that aside. Literally and figuratively, and continue. So, the dream metaphor now is being used by Shankara, not in the conventional ways, but in this very powerful way and less common way of using it to establish non-duality. And we'll see that now. We saw just the first part of this verse, so we'll pick up the thread here, yes. Yena veti sa veda syat, yena veti sa veda syat, swapne sarvam tu mayaya, swapne sarvam tu mayaya, yena pasyati tat chakshuhu, yena chasyati tat chakshuhu, shrunoti shrotra muchyate, shunoti shrotra. Alright. Shrunoti is just written incorrectly. Shrinoti. It should be the vowel r. Okay. Shrunoti. Okay, up at the top. Saha Vedaha Syat Swapne. Swapne, in a dream. Saha Vedaha Syat, whatever objects you observe, yena veti, are the same as that by which they are known. Sanskrit has this wonderful facility for connecting pronouns. We don't really have the same thing in English, so it's hard to give an exact translation of this in English. Yena veti, that consciousness by which objects are known in a dream, swapne, by that same consciousness, saha vedaha syat. The objects seen are the same, are that. Saha vedaha, are that. Vedaha, the objects known, by the way, veda Veda has met, don't think of Veda as only meaning the scriptures. In fact, Veda can be a verb. Veda can also be in this context, an object known. So it's not talking about scriptures here. So this opening line captures what I told you in the introduction, and that is, in a dream, there's no duality. The observer is consciousness. The observed are consciousness with forms. Same consciousness. So the forms are not as real as consciousness. So the only reality present in a dream is consciousness. Can you see where this is going? We're going to see two or three verses on the metaphor of the dream, and then we're going to flip over to the waking state. Just a sneak preview. Just as we resolve duality in a dream state, we can use that same approach to resolve duality in the waking state. In a dream state, there's one reality present in the form of knower and known. Right now, there's one reality present in the form of knower and known. We may use different words. In a dream, we can say consciousness or atma. Atma in the form of knower, atma in the form of known. In the waking state, we may use a different word. Brahman. Brahman in the form of knower, Brahman in the form of known. We'll come to that after several verses. I'm just giving you the sneak preview, as it were. So everything in a dream, sarvam, in the second line, sarvam tu, but everything that you see in a dream appears mayaya, due to magic. Due to magic. By the way, there's a little bit of magic in this pot, because it's sitting in my hand. You didn't see anyone turn clay into a pot. Right now, in this moment, it's kind of a miracle that there is such a thing as a pot. So there is some magical power which is unseen to us in the present moment that caused clay to appear in the form of this pot. So even here, there's a kind of maya involved, because right now you have no idea, was this made in India? Was it made where? Nothing. I don't see anything that distinguishes it anyway. So this is maya. Maya here in the context of your dream is, remember we've said several times that in Advaita Vedanta, maya is used as a technical term, not in a common sense of illusion or magic, but in a technical term as a capacity for creation. That's we say maya shakti, the power of maya. Well, what kind of power? There are several ways of describing that maya. Here, the power of creation. Maya shakti, and here is the capacity to cause the entire universe to come into existence. Maya shakti, in the context of your dream, is the capacity to cause pure, undifferentiated consciousness to appear as trees and cows and grass and everything else in a field. This is maya shakti, understood properly now, as a creative capacity. So, sarvam tu mayaya. Because of that creative capacity, one undifferentiated consciousness appears as all the many objects in your form. The commentator says here, the commentator observes that this shows how the language he uses is this jnatra jnata bhava, I think is his very words. This state in which there's a knower and known. He says that condition or state where there's both a knower and known, he says that state is mayika. It is due to the creative capacity of maya. And that's, even now, that's so obvious. Here we are, sitting in a world of duality. We understand from the ancient rishis that there's only one undifferentiated Brahman. So how did we go from one undifferentiated Brahman to our present experience of duality? There are two answers to that. One is, I don't know. And that's actually a valid answer. That's, in fact, it's better than many other answers, is to just say, I don't know. And the other is, and here we can be a little more philosophical, we can infer. And this is a valid inference. There must be. Let me set up the inference properly. If what exists is one undifferentiated Brahman, and if our experience is not one undifferentiated Brahman, but this world of duality, we can the easy inference is there's a cause. The more complex inference is that cause has to have a creative power. And that creative power we call Maya. Okay, enough said. And we'll see this applied then to the waking state in a few minutes. So here, in the first half of this verse, Shankara establishes that all the objects you see in a dream are nothing but consciousness. There's no distinction between knower and known. Now we're going to, in the next verse and a half, Shankara shifts to the other side of the equation. One side of the equation is the known. The other side of the equation is the knower. So what about the knower? To see the tree in a dream, you need eyes, right? But not these eyes. These eyes won't help you see. By the way, can blind people see in a dream? Yes, if. If they lost their sight later in life, they can, in fact, dream of seeing. If they were born blind, probably not. But if they lost their sight, that dream person can see things in a dream. So seeing things in a dream doesn't depend on these eyes. It depends on having eyes. We'll have fun with this. Suppose you lose your sight in a dream. Can you see the dream tree? No. You need dream eyes to see the dream tree. And the dream tree is made of consciousness. The dream eyes are made of consciousness, which is what Shankara says here. Yena pasyati tachakshuhu. Tachakshuhu. The eyes. That eye, those eyes with which you see things in a dream. Tachakshuhu pasyati. The eyes with which you see things in a dream. Yena. And this is again the Sanskrit facility for using pronouns, which is untranslatable in English. So I'll have to paraphrase. So yena, by the consciousness because of which everything exists in a dream, tachakshuhu, that consciousness are your dream eyes. Shrotram uchyate, shrotram shrinoti uchyate, and the ears with which you hear sounds in a dream, yena, is the same as the consciousness because of which everything exists in the dream. And this line of thought continues. Yena swapna gato vakti, yena swapna gato vakti, savagranam tathaivacha, savagranam tathaivacha, rasana sparshane chaiva, rasana sparshane chaiva, manaschanyatatendriyam, manaschanyat. Sa vag vakti. We have to connect these words. So here in the dream you can talk. Generally, we can talk in a dream. So sa vag vyakti, that faculty of speech, savak, by which vyakti, by which you can speak, that faculty of speech, svapnagataha, in the dream, that faculty of speech, yena, is identical to the consciousness because of which everything in the dream exists. And the same goes for granam, your faculty of smelling. By the way, the faculty of smelling is not your nose. Your nose is this is this fleshy object hanging on the front of your face very awkwardly. The faculty of smelling are the nerves inside the nose. So, and just to make a minor distinction here. So, the faculty of speech that you use in a dream is nothing but consciousness, plus namarupa. The faculty of smell you have in a dream is nothing but consciousness, plus namarupa. The same for rasana, capacity to taste. If you eat interesting, if you eat food in a dream, does it have taste? Why not? Sure. And so, when your faculty of taste in a dream is nothing but consciousness, sparshane, your faculty of touch in a dream, also manahacha, your mind, can you think in a dream? Of course. Anyat tata indriyam, and other faculties, can you feel emotions in a dream? Most certainly. So all of these faculties that you use to see objects, let's go back to the two parts. All of the faculties that you use to see objects are made of consciousness. The objects that you see with those faculties, or experience, or perceive, I should say, the objects perceived are consciousness. Faculties of the person, in fact, we can have one more. I need a third hand. I'll show you why. The objects perceived are consciousness. The faculties with which the objects are perceived by consciousness, and whatever the faculties pick up are known by consciousness. There's my third hand. There's only consciousness in that dream. This is, as I said before, where this goes is, and the point of this dashtanta, excuse me, is that in the dream there is nothing but consciousness plus namarupa. Namarupa is not a second thing, as we demonstrated with the pot. So in the consciousness, there is no duality. I'm sorry, in the dream, there is no duality. There is only consciousness. Right now, there is Brahman present as consciousness. let's get all three hands going again. Brahman in the form of objects. Easy? So, my body, my chair, whatever you see, hear, taste, touch, smell, all of those objects, Brahman in the form of objects in the waking state. What about your eyeballs? Form of Brahman. So the things seen are forms of Brahman. The faculty by which you see, which is not just your eyes, but your brain and your mind, all of that is necessary for sight. So the objects known are a form of Brahman. The faculties through which these objects are known are a form of Brahman. And how do you know what your eyes pick up? How do you know the images that arise in your mind due to consciousness, which is not a form of Brahman, it's just Brahman. satyam jnanam anantam brahma. And that's what the Mahavakya ultimately reveals, right? There's no difference between Atma and Brahman. So we can absolutely show that. No duality in the waking state. The objects are a form of Brahman. The faculties by which the objects are known are forms of Brahman, and the consciousness by which the objects are known, it's all one Brahman. Non-duality is established in the waking state based on this drishtanta, this metaphor of the dream state. By the way, this drishtanta, no drishtanta, constitutes conclusive proof. It's a supporting proof. So, we're back to Shruti Yukti Anubhava. So this drishtanta is yukti. It's only one of the three pillars on which the teachings of Vedanta. So we're not. Don't think that we rely on this metaphor exclusively to establish non-duality. No. It's one of three ways in which we understand non-duality. We won't go into the Shruti and Anubhava. That's not our topic right now. But just know, if you think about this drishtanta, you say, but what about this? What about that? Because when we're in the realm of logic, it's natural. We have questions. We have doubts. We can challenge. Any argument can be challenged. This is an argument. It can be challenged. The Buddhists would reject it. Many others would reject this argument. So just making the point that Vedanta's teachings on non-duality do not rest exclusively on this metaphor, as powerful as the metaphor is. Okay, now, continue.
Kalpyopadhibhiravaitata bhinnam jnanam anekadha, bhinnam jnanam anekadha, adhi bhedad yatha bhedo, adhi yatha bhedo, Maner ekasya jayate.
Start in the second line. Actually, end of the first line. Etat jnanam. Connect those two words. Etat jnanam. This knowledge, referring to consciousness, the consciousness which is the essence of everything that exists in the dream, that notice that the consciousness in the dream, in fact, Shankara says it here, that consciousness in the dream, actually he doesn't say it here, we have to add it, that consciousness in the dream in and of itself is non-differentiated in the sense that it doesn't really get chopped up. You can't say that the dream tree is a little bit of consciousness. The dream cow is a little bit of consciousness. Because consciousness, how do you chop it up? You can chop up a carrot. You can't chop up consciousness. It's like here, just to make the point, if I break this pot into parts. That's tricky. Metaphor doesn't work very well. But if you break this pot into parts, how does that change clay? Yes, I understand that you've got one piece of clay over here and one piece of clay over there, so the metaphor doesn't work particularly well. But the point, the Vedantic interpretation here would be clay remains clay. The form is affected, clay is not affected. So, based on that perspective, clay, to really understand, we have to go back to our two orders of reality in order to understand this properly. There are two kinds of reality here. There's a fundamental reality, clay, and there's an empirical reality, a transactional reality, it's often called. You can see and interact with a pot. These are two different kinds of reality, just like waking state reality and dream state reality. They're completely different. And since they're completely different, and we've talked about this before, there's no interaction. Right? How does your dream life interact when you're in a dream? I've given the example before. If you're thirsty in a dream, the glass of water next to your bed doesn't help you at all. And vice versa. If you dreamt of a lake last night and you're thirsty when you wake up, that lake full of water won't quench your thirst. There's no interaction whatsoever between different orders of reality. And that's true in the case of the pot. They don't interact. They're simultaneously present, but without actual interaction. And the same is true in a dream. There are forms present in the dream, simultaneously present with consciousness, but it's not like they can interact because they belong to different orders of reality. So, breaking the pot doesn't affect the clay. Or if I take clay and create many pots, the clay continues to be unaffected by its division. It's divided in terms of form. It's divided. In terms of clay, it's still one clay. One clay in many forms. Ah, that's why I'm stuck. There are different the answer to my, remember I said the metaphor doesn't work very well. And it's because there are three kinds of bheda, three kinds of difference. And I'm only talking about one. I'm talking about difference in terms of form. So if you're talking about difference in terms of form, then you can see one pile of clay and one pile of clay here and one pile there. They look different, but that's only one kind of bheda. There's another kind of bheda, which is spatial. This bheda difference is not... This is a little technical. I don't want to get too far into this because you're going to get you're either going to get a headache or you're going to fall asleep. I'm not sure which. We'll see. Let's try it and find out. So if I have two pots, there's an obvious difference between them. There's one form and there's a second form. But watch this. What is the difference between this pot and this pot? Spatial difference. Same clay, but with a spatial difference. Remember before I said one pile, if I break the pot and I put one shard here and one shard here, I said it's one clay. That doesn't seem intuitively correct. But this is why. So if I have two pots, that's one kind of duality. I can have another kind of duality between this pot and this pot. A duality in terms of space, location, and I can have a duality in terms of time. Difference between this pot and this pot. Time. So there are three kinds of bheda difference, but one clay. One clay present in this pot and this pot. One clay present in this pot and this pot. One clay present in this shard and that shard. Sorry for a little technical, but you saw me get stuck a few minutes ago. I had to answer my question. Okay. So one clay in pots, regardless of their division. One undifferentiated clay. And that's what he says here with regard to consciousness. That jnanam, that consciousness, is undifferentiated, but just as clay. is undifferentiated. Consciousness is undifferentiated. But ekadha, it becomes manifold, bhinnam, it becomes separate. How does one consciousness become manifold and separate? Like one clay becomes manifold and separate. We used before, Shankara said, mayaya. Due to some creative capacity, and that's what he refers to in the beginning of the verse. He says, it is kalpya upadibhi. It is due to, and here's our technical word, upadhi. What is upadhi? That conditioning adjunct, as it's translated in English. How about in this context, we can kind of dumb it down. Not that it's necessary, you can understand all this. But we can dumb it down. Upadhi is simply nama-rupa. Is it not? In a simple way, I mean, nama-rupa doesn't capture the technical depth of the word upadhi. But on a superficial level, it's correct. Nama-rupa is upadhi. This pot is clay plus upadhi. Fine, and that upadhi is the name and form pot. So in a dream, you have consciousness plus a kalpya upadhi. Kalpya means projected. A projected upadhi, meaning the tree in a dream is one kalpya upadhi. The cow in a dream, another kalpya upadhi. The green grass in that field, another kalpya upadhi. Many upadhis superimposed on one. Many upadhi in a dream. Many upadhis superimposed on one undifferentiated consciousness, like we can have many kinds of pots superimposed on one undifferentiated clay. And notice that in the dream, remember, three hands. So that one, remember, first hand are the objects you see in a dream. The second hand is the sense organs, faculties with which you see those objects. And my third hand is those deities with four arms. They got something going for them. That's good. Or how about Durga with her 10 arms? How much she can do? Anyway. So, we got objects, we got senses by which those objects are seen, and we got consciousness. Notice, undifferentiated consciousness is differentiated in two different ways. Undifferentiated consciousness is differentiated into knower and known. See that? One undifferentiated consciousness becomes, in a dream, knower with the sense faculties and known. Of course, knower and known are due to upadhis. Consciousness is the underlying reality. This is a brilliant metaphor. And to apply it in the waking state, we'll go back to our three hands. The objects are Brahman with nama-rupa, your faculty of sight, Brahman with nama-rupa, upadhi, and consciousness, which is Brahman. Superimposed. The division, the first Brahman gains one upadhi of faculty of sight. Brahman gains another upadhi, object known. So notice that the duality of knower and known comes due to this projection, maya. The commentator said, Mayika. So this, yes, this is a little technical, but notice our subject matter. We are now refuting duality. That's a pretty heavy subject matter, and we're discussing it. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's not that hard. We are refuting duality in this way with this powerful drishtanta. Okay, I got a funny. Actually, I'm going to leave that note off. Okay, it's up. Leave it. Shankara gives another metaphor. People have observed that they like my teaching because I use so many metaphors. Where do you think I get it from? Vedanta is rich with these metaphors. So we get one after another. So we got the dream metaphor. Oh, this is good. Watch this. This is my, that's why I had to understand my note. My note, by the way, is pretty cryptic. D squared. No wonder I didn't understand it. What is D squared? D means drishtanta. D squared means a drishtanta on a drishtanta. So the dream is a drishtanta, right? Now Shankara introduces a drishtanta to explain the dream drishtanta. D squared. We're using a drishtanta. Shankara uses a drishtanta to explain a drishtanta, D squared. And that's what we see in the second half here. He says, yata. Yata is often used to introduce a drishtanta. We're already talking about a drishtanta. Now he introduces another one. He says, it is yata, just like manehe, for a money. Money, gem, or crystal. So he says, yata, manehe, just like for a money, for a gem or for a crystal. For a crystal, ekasya manihi, for one crystal, bhedaha jayate, differences occur for one crystal. Here we need to demonstrate. Right now, does it look orange? I have to get it at the right distance or it won't look orange. Does it look orange? From this, actually, I can look in the screen. Right here, I can see. So it looks orange. Try that. It's off the screen. Okay, yeah, I'll try this. Here we go. There we go. Now what color is it? Orange, black. Orange, black. Ekasya mani, mani, hey, for one crystal. Bheda jayate. Differences arise. How? Adhi bhedat. Adhi here refers to location. So according to the environment, according to what's nearby, adhi is that which is near. So here, what is near is orange cloth. Here is what's near is a black phone. So according to the proximity, we've used this term before, it's a matter of proximity. When there is proximity of this clear crystal to an object that has color, the color that belongs to the object is superimposed. The prior verse, first line, he used the term kalpya upadhi, a projected namarupa. Orange is a projected namarupa. Black is a projected namarupa. So here, Shankara is explaining what happens in a dream, which is a drishtanta. He's using a drishtanta to explain the drishtanta. This is our D, this is my D squared note. Very strange. And what he's describing is what happens in our minds. When, again and again, I've said, when consciousness is in the proximity of the mind, and proximity is crucial because Consciousness is not only in your mind, it's everywhere else. But when consciousness is in the presence of your mind, amazing things take place. In fact, you take place. That's how you arise as an individual being. The most fundamental definition of jiva. Jiva means individual being. Literally, it means living being. But suppose we could take your essence somehow and put it in a computer or put it in a test tube. Wouldn't be alive, but if you can still think inside that computer or inside that, don't ask me if it's possible or not, this is all science fiction, but if you can be somehow transported into a computer, remember that Matrix movie? It did that nicely. So if you could exist inside a computer simulation, or if you could exist somehow in a test tube, you wouldn't be alive, but you would still exist as an individual. So that's why I'm saying jiva literally means living being, and that was a good definition 1,000 years ago. But when they figure out how to put you inside a computer or a test tube, then jiva won't be a useful word anymore, because your existence doesn't depend on being alive. In the most fundamental sense, your existence is consciousness plus mind. Proximity. You are a conscious individual being. The term often uses sentient being. Some people think that sentient being is not a very common word. To me it's common. Sentient being, I think the dictionary definition of sentient is one who can experience. You have the faculty of experience. Consciousness in and of itself doesn't experience. What does consciousness in and of itself experience? Take the example of deep sleep. Consciousness is present. So what is it experiencing? Consciousness doesn't experience. Let me just make a decision if I want to go on or not. Actually, let's just unfold this idea a little bit here instead of going on to the... If we go on to the next verse, we'll be kind of rushed at the end of class. So let's just examine this a little bit. Who are you in the most fundamental sense? First of all, you don't even need this test tube stuff to demonstrate that you don't have to have a body to be alive. So you can set aside those science fiction-y examples of computer and test tube, because in a dream, you continue to exist with the functional absence of your body. Yes, your body still exists, but in a dream, your physical body is not present. And it doesn't make any difference if you had a horrible accident and lost your legs. You can walk around just fine in your dream. So there's, again, no relationship between these two states of existence. So what I'm saying is, in your dream, you are experientially without your physical body. Set that functionally aside. In a dream, you don't experience your physical body, obviously. Which means, in that dream, you have experiences independent of your physical body. Those experiences in a dream don't depend on your physical body. That's all we're trying to establish. And we're trying to establish, who are you in the most fundamental sense? Well, in a dream, you can exist without your body. So in a fundamental sense, your existence doesn't depend on your physical body, and your own dream experience is enough to establish that. Here's an interesting question. And think twice before answering this. In deep sleep, do you exist as an individual person? I'm just curious. How many think you do exist as an individual person? How many think you don't? To exist as an individual, you have to experience yourself as an individual person. In deep sleep, do you say, "Here I am" in deep sleep? You don't experience yourself as an individual person in deep sleep. Which means you, as an individual person, Jiva in our very refined meaning, you don't exist as an individual person in deep sleep. You do exist as an individual person right now. You do exist as an individual person in dream. You cease to experience yourself. In fact, let me change my language. You experience yourself. I'm using exist, that's too abstract. Right now, you experience yourself, "I am me." How's that? I am me. Right now, you can say, "I am me." In a dream, you can say, "I am me." Can you have that experience of saying, "I am me" in deep sleep? No. So what is the difference? What's missing in deep sleep? In a dream, your body is missing, but you can still say, "I am me." In deep sleep, you can't say, "I am me," because not only is your body missing, your mind also is missing. Consciousness is present, but mind is missing. This is what there's a little technical, but you're following it just fine. This leads to this really basic definition of who you are as a sentient being. The minimum, what do they say on these vitamin things? Minimum daily requirement. So here, not daily requirement, the minimum requirement for Jiva is individual sentient being, consciousness plus mind. One more factor, as long as we're doing this. Consciousness plus mind. An enlightened person will say, "I'm not an individual being." Does an enlightened person have a mind or not? So what's going on here? So this is the end of our discussion, by the way. But this is a little... I don't think we've ever talked this. So this is a little sophisticated. We said, to be a sentient being requires consciousness plus mind. Body is optional. So, minimum requirement, consciousness plus mind. Individual being, you said. An enlightened person has consciousness and mind, but the enlightened person says, "I am not an individual being. I am all-pervasive consciousness." So there must be another factor then, in addition to, so you have consciousness and mind, you say, "I am me." An enlightened person has consciousness and mind and says, "I am not me. I am pure consciousness, all pervasive." So there must be another factor differentiating the two. And the factor, as most of you have figured out, ignorance. So you are a combination of three factors: consciousness, mind, and ignorance. Or in Vedantic terminology, chit, सूक्ष्म शरीर कारण शरीर कारण शरीर इज जस्ट इग्नोरेंस. नोटिस स्थूल शरीर इज ऑप्शनल बट कॉन्शियसनेस प्लस माइंड सूक्ष्म शरीर प्लस ignorance, karana sharira, individual being. Enlightened person, consciousness, plus mind, without ignorance. But still consciousness and mind, which means you can still have experience. And enlightened, to have experience, you require consciousness and mind. But to experience yourself as an individual being, you need a third factor, ignorance. So with that third factor, you can say, I am me. Without that third factor, the enlightened person can't say, well, can say, I am me, but they're just, enlightened person can say anything. I'm an idiot. Anything they want to say, they can say. But you get my point. The enlightened person can have ordinary experiences, but will not have the, well, this gets even more complicated. We have a few minutes left. Does an enlightened person experience the sense of individuality? We're taking this one more level. We're just for fun. We're just taking an idea and taking it step by step by step. So we said the enlightened person doesn't have that ignorance. But then but the enlightened person still has a mind. So the leading question is, does the enlightened person experience individuality? And we've actually, you know, we've talked about this many times. If the enlightened person experiences himself or herself as limitless consciousness, how can they function? So there has to be some kind of functional identification with the body and mind, which isn't a form of thoughts. So the point here is the enlightened person with consciousness has no ignorance, but still has a mind full of thoughts. One of those thoughts is called ahankara. The difference is the enlightened person knows ahankara is just a thought. Or to use more helpful language, an enlightened person experiences himself or herself as an individual person, but knows that experience is just a thought. You don't take the experience too seriously. Like the sunset, you see the sun going down, you know the earth is turning. The enlightened person feels like an individual person, doesn't take that feeling of individuality seriously. Okay, we're just spinning along here with Shankara's last idea. This is a good place to conclude for today. Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha, sarve santu niramayaha, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kashchid dukha bhag bhavet, asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityorma amritangamaya. Om shanti shanti shanti. Om tat sat. All right, that is off.